The U.S. Food and Drug Administration now has the power and the protocols to police the nation's food chain. This leads us to ask, can local agriculture survive the FDA's food safety police?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 910th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there on Kowloon's side as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels and daughter Mariah Michaels on the boards. Hello.
Glad to be here. Say hi.
Hi.
There you go. Also, we have with us intern producer Dylan Thompson. Dylan, welcome aboard.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, folks, whoever you know, have a little thing here. What the heck is it here? A special welcome today to our new friends in tuning in today in Missouri, Iowa, and Illinois on WGEM in Quincy. And also to our new friends in Pennsylvania who are tuned in on WEEU in Reading. So pleased to be with you today. What a great privilege it is for us to speak with you. And for all of you new folks out there, you can always join us on the phone on the live programming at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. Or if you're delayed, you can always join us on the forums or on the archives at metrofarm.com. Go there. You can find the Food Chain page archived. You can comment. You can raise all kinds of heck, as a lot of our friends do. Well, folks, file this program under Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Back when we lived on the land and grew our own food, we had a lot of control over what was in our food. But we have since moved into town, and our food, it is claimed, now travels on average well over 1,000 miles from where it was grown. In fact, some of our food, even the organic kind, comes from China, which is well over 6,000 miles away. Thus, we no longer have much control over what's in our food, and some of our food is making us sick. How sick? Foodborne illnesses now kill an estimated 3,000 people every year here in the United States. In the waning hours of 2010, the U.S. Congress passed the Food Safety Modernization Act, which granted the Food and Drug Administration the power to police the nation's food chain. Instead of simply reacting to foodborne contaminations, the FDA, which is now under former Monsanto executive Michael Taylor, will now protect us against foodborne illnesses by policing the nation's food chain. Now, after 2 years of planning, the FDA has placed well over 1,000 pages of new food safety protocols on the table for discussion. These rules and regulations were designed kind of as a one-size-fits-all for agriculture. However, the United States now has two sizes of agriculture, an industrial-sized agriculture that produces foods for distant markets, and a local-sized agriculture that produces food for local markets. With 1,000 pages of new rules and regulations, Michael Taylor's food police will soon have life and death authority over all farmers. This leads us to ask, has our food chain become so dangerous it must be policed by the federal government? How will the federal food police protect us from contaminated foods? And finally, can local agriculture survive all that 1,000 pages of rules and regulations put forth by the FDA's food safety police? Wow, lots of fun things to work with today, and we're going to work with them. First, we have two very interesting people to work with today. First, Sandra Eskin, who is the director of the Pew Charitable Trust's Food Safety Program. Sandra, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you aboard. Now, first of all, what is the Pew Charitable Trust?
The Pew Charitable Trust is a large nonprofit that works on a whole range of policy issues. So we work with a lot of projects that deal with the environment, many that deal with state-based policies like corrections and pre-K, and we have a number of projects that deal with various issues related to food policy. My project focuses on limiting pathogenic bacteria and other viruses and such in the food supply. We have a project that's aimed at getting animal drugs out of agriculture, specifically antibiotics out of animal agriculture. We have one that's aimed at making sure the chemicals that we put into our food are safe. So we do a lot of work on a whole lot of issues. My area focuses on one aspect of food policy.
And that's safety.
Safety. And
then you're just the perfect person to be talking to today. Sandra, we always ask who pays the way. So who pays the way for the charitable trusts?
It is seven trusts that are owned by the heirs of the Sunoco Oil Company many, many years back. These trusts were established, and again, the funds are dedicated to identifying problem areas in government policy, be it in the local, state, federal area, and coming up with solutions that work for everyone.
Well, good. So oil out, doing good. Also with us today, we have David Runston, who is the policy director for the Community Alliance with Family Farmers, which we all know as CAF. David, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. Happy to be here.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Will you tell us a little bit about Community Alliance with Family Farmers?
CAF has been around about 30 years. We just work in California. We represent a lot of small farms and organic farmers here in the state. We work on policy. We're part of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition nationally, and I'm the co-chair of the Food Safety Committee for that national organization.
Good enough. And who pays the way for CAF?
We have money from foundations, from individuals, and from the government, as well as from our members.
Okay, fair enough. So two food safety people here today, so we're going to have some fun talking food safety. Well, yesterday's news, I just picked up the Wall Street Journal, and there it was. Officials from the Peanut Corporation of America are being charged by the federal government for deliberately selling peanut butter contaminated with salmonella. Multi-year fraud. Holy smoke, sick and hundred, killed nine. What's going on with our food chain? Let's start with you, Sandra. Why is this happening?
Sure. Well, let me just make a note that the case against the Peanut Corporation of America is based on existing law, meaning before the Food Safety Modernization Act was enacted, FSMA. And ultimately, what the Food and Drug Act says is people cannot put into the marketplace food that is, the term legally is adulterated, that's contaminated. And there is an outbreak linked to this company's peanut products, peanut paste, which are used in thousands of products, whether it's peanut butter crackers or cereal or ice cream. And from 2008 to 2009, there was a very large outbreak of salmonella. Nine people died, and the evidence, apparently, again, I don't work for the Justice Department, I'm not a prosecutor, but the evidence, at least, that was presented publicly in hearings was pretty damning in the sense that company officials knew they tested the product as they were required at the time by the people who bought their products. They found salmonella contamination, and allegedly, they kept testing until they found a sample that didn't have it, and they shipped it. That is, again, what I know publicly, what I saw in the hearing. I'm guessing that the Justice Department took as long as it did to bring this case because there was they needed to get all evidence. This company, I believe, is an outlier. There are so many companies out there that are growing food and producing food and doing the right thing, but it's important when you've got someone acting recklessly, negligently, and killing people, they should be held responsible.
Well, David, it's not just peanuts from Georgia. It's eggs from Iowa, cantaloupes from Colorado, baby formula from China, spinach from California. What's going on?
I think we've always had people get sick from eating food. I don't think that's something new that's happened. I think we're doing a better job of figuring out, how it's happening. I do think there are more pathogens in the environment. I do think, that we have created a more dangerous environment in which to grow and process and eat food. And so,
why is that?
What's that?
Yes. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, but that certainly provides us a place to come back to. Why have we created a more dangerous environment for pathogens? You know, I remember growing up on the farm and milking cows in a barn filled with cow manure and carrying buckets of milk across the barnyard filled with chicken manure and pouring it in the separator and drinking it and never getting sick. So, and what's different today? We will be right back to find out on The Food Chain.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie benchlands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, here we are. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael also are talking about the safety of our food. You eat, I eat, we all eat. And now we are vulnerable to the foods we eat because it appears as though we're having some trouble with the foods we eat. Gosh, it's just yesterday the officials from the Food or the Peanut Corporation of America accused by the federal government of deliberately selling us salmonella contaminated peanut butter. Nice, except if you happen to get sick, as hundreds have, and 9 were killed by this peanut butter. So how do we protect ourselves? Well, one thing we're doing is looking to the federal government, who has, through the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2010, instituted a food police. And after 2 years of deliberation, have planned for the protocols to give those food police so they can go out upon the land and make food safe. And that's the conversation we're having today. Dave Runston with Community Alliance with Family Farmers and also Sandra Eskin, the Pew Charitable Trust. David, you were talking a little bit about how we have created a more dangerous environment. And how exactly have we done that?
Well, I think, I think bacteria, viruses, I think these have evolved, mutated, have created things that are pathogenic to humans in different novel ways. And so I think, many areas, have become contaminated in different ways. And, we believe that you can trace it back to the confined animal feeding operations, and the diets that they're fed, tend to produce more of these pathogens. I think that the question is, how can we operate in an environment where we're pumping more and more of these pathogens into the environment?
Now, Sandra Eskin, you were talking a little bit about how one of the things that Pew Charitable Trust is focusing on with respect to food safety is the effort to reduce our use of antibiotics. Now, is there any correlation between antibiotics and these virulent new strains of pathogens that we're manufacturing?
Well, they're being created in many different ways. But I think that is one of the major public health concerns, whether it's a foodborne infection or, frankly, any infection. The more antibiotics in the environment as a whole, the more these prompt pathogens to mutate, and you are creating a situation where the antibiotics that used to work no longer work. So it is a serious public health problem, and Pew, along with many other public health and consumer groups, are really pushing for steps to be taken to address this serious public health problem.
Okay, so that's certainly something we need to be looking at, and I'm sure the food safety police are going to be out there with their Uzis making sure that none of this happens. But let me bring up something else here, and that's distance from food. As I jokingly crafted these three rules of the food chain, the second one being the farther we get from the source of our food, the less control we have over that food. And it appears to be a lot of these big contaminations are coming from large industrial scale operations somewhere far away. And it seems like by the time the food gets to us, you know, we're all in big trouble. So I asked a Bill Marler, who is an attorney who specializes in food safety litigation. So, you know, when there's an incidence of food contamination, he goes out and collects all of the victims and then he sues the company. And I did a radio program with him and I asked him, you know, Bill, you've been at this for 20 years. Have you ever seen a case in which these contaminations have come from, like, the farmer's market or something? And he said, no, I've never run across anything like that. So let me ask both of you, do you see a correlation between these industrial-scale contaminations and the distance we have grown from our food? Let's start with you, Dave.
Well, I mean, the long-distance shipping you know, produces most of the food. You know, they account for the vast majority of the produce that's eaten. And so it's just inevitable, right, that the incidents are going to show up in that system. You know, the small people sell directly to the public to a large extent. People know exactly where it came from. It's certainly true that the, you know, less shelf life you have, perhaps, you know, less chance there is of the bacteria multiplying and so forth. You know, cutting up things, you know, that creates danger. Putting it in a bag and shipping it around, you know, where it needs to be kept cold all the time, you know, those create dangers. You know, there's just many things in the large-scale food system, you know, that has potential danger to it that you wouldn't find, you know, buying something directly from a farmer at a farmer's market.
Mm-hmm. Sandra, you mentioned the incredible use of antibiotics, and that would certainly be something that you would almost have to do in large-scale operations to minimize, you know, the sicknesses of animals. I mean, if one little cold gets into the herd, that everybody gets it, and then productivity falls off. So you use antibiotics to protect against that. Is that a function of distance too, do you think?
Let me respond to that, Michael, but I also want to follow up on some of the things that Dave said.
Sure.
I think with antibiotics, again, it's not for treatment of disease that there's a concern, because if the animal is sick, you should treat the animal. But the use of these drugs as growth promoters, that is the real concern here. And I, to be honest with you, I don't work as closely on the CAFO, the concentrated animal feeding operation, or the antibiotic issue to really respond to your question. I think it is a concern if you look, obviously, at where these facilities are located around the country and you follow the food. Mm-hmm. But that's what I want to get back to. The question is, you know, we have such a distance between the producer and the consumer. I think what you have to look at, again, is the whole chain. And what happens is, obviously, the more people and things that are done to food between the time it's harvested and eaten, the more opportunity you have for contamination, be it from the environment in the processing facility outside or the handlers. So I think there's intuitively a concern. I will say that, you know, we're still doing what we can to look at the evidence and to see what we have. Bill Marler is right to the degree that we don't have a lot of examples of contaminations that occur in farmers markets close to home, but I can assure you there are instances when that has happened. Again, because it's probably a shorter distance and fewer people get sick, but people still get sick. And mm-hmm. that's not to say that local food isn't as safe. You know, it's clearly, you know, our food supply overall is safe. Can it be safer? Absolutely. And that is true at every single step.
Fair enough. I had a conversation with young intern producer Dylan Thompson here about with respect to the ethics of all of this, and got to thinking about the ethics of distance. And this gentleman who ran the Peanut Corporation of America, Stuart Parnell, and deliberately ignoring the evidence of a salmonella contamination in his peanut butter and sending it out into the world for people to eat all the way across the nation and the world, in fact. And, you know, to heck with it. Get it out there. That's valuable stuff. So you get it out there regardless of what the heck is in it. So it's contaminated with salmonella. Who cares? Get it out the door. Now, if you were selling that peanut butter to your next-door neighbor, I think there would be a different consideration there.
Certainly, and there's a relationship. That's what you're going toward, Michael, right?
Well, I'm going to ask you both to comment on the ethics of distance when we get back from the break here. But I wonder, you know, the people growing chickens in China and using all the bacterial and hormone growth inducers and then putting those chickens into the food chain because they don't know where their chickens are going. So why should I care? I'm just going to make the money. I don't care where my peanut butter is going. Why should I? I'm going to make the money for my stockholders. I got to make the money. So where is this taking us? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson right back with Sandra Eskin, David Runston, and you. Join us. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Sandra Eskin, from the Food Safety Director of the Pew Charitable Trust Food Safety Program. Also David Runston, who is the Policy Director at Community Alliance with Family Farmers. We're talking about food safety. How can we guarantee safe food? I have a friend out in the Shenandoah River Valley, Joel Salatin by name, who once brought up the idea of food safety should be a matter of distance. He said, by golly, if I'm going to butcher a steer or chickens or something and sell it to my next door neighbor, I don't need the federal police involved in this transaction because it's just something between me and my neighbor. And if something goes wrong, well, it's all going to get straightened out really quickly. But, you know, if I'm like buying peanuts from the Peanut Corporation of America, then perhaps we should have the federal police looking after that organization. And furthermore, the money to pay for that should not come from taxpayers. Perhaps it should come from the people who buy the peanut butter. What do you think of that notion, David Runston?
I think it's fine for the government, you know, to regulate the food supply. Right? I think we do have lots of incidents and problems that could have been avoided. And they need to figure out, you know, where those problems are and do what they can to prevent them. I agree with that completely. Our problem arises when, you know, they impose some sort of regulations on lots of farmers, you know, where there's no evidence that there's ever been any kind of problem, where they devise rules, you know, because they sit in an office in Washington and they look at some data from a study that says pathogens can survive for a year, so we're not going to allow any animals to graze in your field for, say, 9 months before you harvest a crop. And, you know, the organic rule is 4 months, and so now they want to extend it to 9 months. Well, that makes it impossible for people to do all of these animal type things, the chicken tractors, the grazing of, you know, grass-fed animals out in the fields and eating crop stubble and so forth. And so that's an example of the kind of thing in these rules, you know, where we feel like, you know, they're trying to impose some sort of scientific thing in a way that's probably not appropriate, you know, in the majority of cases.
I know where you can go to grow, David. The moon. No wild animals there. Sandra Eskin, what do you think? I mean, should the same rules apply for all? I mean, should
they don't. They don't, Michael. Let me just respond to a couple things. And certainly Dave may disagree, and that's totally understandable. But let me start with number one. The federal government does not regulate any food transactions that, at least as far as safety goes, that occur within a state. The federal government is interstate, not intrastate. So the issues around Joel Saladin in, you know, Virginia, or someone in Salinas Valley who's growing, you know, something to their neighbors, that's done at the state and local level. That's number one. Number two, there really is no police force. Trust me, those of us who are concerned that the federal government, you know, should be inspecting more.
Well, then what is the FDA looking for all the money for?
Let me keep going for a moment, please, and I'm happy to discuss that. I mean, there's a lot of things they do, and inspections do cost a lot of money. That's the reality of the system. Some of us are fighting to make sure they're not as expensive. And there is a discussion underway that maybe we need to have some sort of industry fee that they pay in order to help ensure that the products are safer. Those are all on the table. But what's most important on the table is FDA has put out 1,000-plus draft regulations, proposed regulations, and all of us all over the country who care about agriculture and safe food and sustainability and organic should be reading those rules, no matter how deadly that might seem for some, and comment. I think FDA is making a good-faith effort, and we certainly are holding them to it, to go out, to have field hearings, to talk to real farmers in real situations. They're trying to be flexible. As Dave mentioned, the issue of animal intrusion is a thorny one because it impacts not only food safety but conservation. You don't like the rule? I don't like the standard? Tell FDA in writing, in person. There are hearings. Go to the website and tell them what they need to know. They're really trying hard not to do a one-size-fits-all, not to be inflexible. There are exemptions in the rule as far as which crops are going to be subject or covered by the rules, and what farms and establishments. As Dave well knows, there's a exemption in the rule, in the law that's reflected in the rules that was advocated by many in the sustainability area, in fact, the coalition that he belongs to. And there are ways that the government is trying to balance the interests of not putting too much burden on growers, but at the same time protecting public health. It's not an easy balance to meet, but I think it's important to know they're trying, and all of us should be telling them how to get it right.
Do you think that giving this kind of authority to the federal government puts us at danger of politicizing the whole process, so that whoever's in charge of all the rules and regulations can determine, you know, which kind of agriculture they like? Or is that just way out of line?
I don't think that's always a concern. Let me just say that. That's obviously a legitimate concern. But we have to look at what the law says and obviously how it's interpreted. There are lots of ways that can be, that concerns can be addressed. Again, I mentioned exemption. The whole regulatory approach says to a grower, if you in fact are covered because you're big enough or whatever, and you think you have a way that's better than the way that we're suggesting, what's your alternative? You can do that. So I think it is very important. I understand Senator Tester's whole motivation for his exemption. I talked to him directly about it. He's very articulate and very thoughtful.
We had him on the food chain show here, and he's
great.
Very good.
I said, I don't want to do anything in our laws that will somehow enable and facilitate greater concentration of the food supply. I get that. I totally understand that. That has economic and health and other impacts. At the same time, there are other values and interests and concerns like public health that need to be.
Now, David Brunston, let me ask you this. In charge of the federal, the Food and Drug Administration's food safety program is a very political character by the name of Michael Taylor, former executive of the Monsanto Corporation. Now, do you think there is any risk in a very political person using these rules and regulations in a very political way?
Well, as Sandra said, there's always a risk of that in any government. I don't know. I mean, you know, the large corporate interests have a great deal of money to spend on lobbying and influencing what the government does. And so I do think it's incumbent on all of us to comment on this. You'll remember when the National Organic Rule came out, right? Many people across the country commented and stopped, you know, the inclusion of sewage sludge and GMOs and other things in organic. And I think, you know, we face the same thing here. People are going to have to speak up and say what kinds of things are going to put them out of business or are unacceptable in some way.
Okay, and speaking of speaking up, we're going to go to the phones when we get back. So folks are invited to join us here on the Food Chain Radio program. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Is our food safe and how can we keep it that way? Right back. Well, what do you think out there? Can local agriculture survive 1,000 new food safety protocols being laid on the table by the federal government to ensure our food safety? And wait a minute. Will these 1,000 protocols ensure our food safety, Sandra?
Hopefully, it will go toward reducing the burden of illness and the impact on growers when they have food safety problems. So nothing is guaranteed, but hopefully with input from all of us, scientists, growers, public health people, we'll get regulations that will hopefully improve public health.
David?
Well, if they focus on the places that are having problems and find the peanut corporations of America and fix them up, then I would say yes. If they put all the organic farmers, small farmers, and everyone out of business, then I really doubt it. So, you know, I hope that we find a balance in this somehow.
Why would you think we'd find a balance? Have you ever seen a situation where we found actually had a balance?
Well, we need to push back. We need to convince the FDA that biodiversity, you know, is a good thing, and that, you know, a totally sterile kind of agriculture is really just not feasible, you know, nor is it beneficial.
David, I'm not certain many people understand the implications of what's going on here with respect to what you say about sterile agriculture. Perhaps you could define that for us.
Well, I mean, there's a tendency sometimes in public health circles to think that, you know, making things cleaner and cleaner, you know, is going to be better. You know, an organic farm is essentially a balance, you know, of good bacteria and bad bacteria, of good things and bad things. And it's that balance, really, that we believe, you know, produces safe food.
And so for a quick example, organic farmers I know are encouraging each other to plant hedgerows in order to encourage the a population of beneficial critters. Whereas the other side of the coin, the industrial scale kind of people say, no, you have to get rid of all life, right? That kind of...
Well, there's a kind of clean fields mentality in American agriculture, which has been, you know, helped along by all the herbicides and so forth. And yeah, it's decreased wildlife and it's decreased, you know, a lot of beneficial insects and bees and so forth. We support planting that kind of cover, and we've been trying to demonstrate that it doesn't represent a danger to these crops and so forth. But sometimes, you know, it's the way that things are being harvested by machine or something. They're trying to keep rodents and frogs and things out of the machine and so forth. So it's not always food safety. Sometimes, you know, there are other considerations involved. But
fair enough. So essentially we have these two kinds of agriculture trying to come to grips with 1,000 new regulations. Let's go to the phones and see what our listeners have to say. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Let's try Steve. Steve, thank you for joining us on the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Can you hear me okay?
Gotcha.
Yeah, I was listening to your show. I've been quite often now, and it's a very good program today. And the one thing that nobody ever brings up about how everybody is getting sick and from these various E. coli or salmonella and this and that, and they always go back to, you know, dirty this or dirty that. And my thing is I think our society is trying to become too clean. And with all the sanitizers and everything for washing your hands and being ingrained, and what I am seeing is I'm seeing more people get sick because what they're doing is they're hurting their own immune system. Their immune system on their body was there for a reason, and that is to take care of your body from infections and this and that. And we're fighting, we're basically downgrading our immune system by trying to be even too clean.
Well, Steve, David was just talking about that. Let's ask Sandra what she thinks about being too clean.
Well, I want to start by saying I'm a lawyer, not a doctor or public health official. And as an aside,
are you saying something about the cleanliness of lawyers?
Yes.
Just
no, I was going to do a shout out to my fellow graduates of UC Hastings Law School.
Okay.
Anyway, answer your question is, I think you can't make general statements. You have to look at what you're talking about in terms mm-hmm. of what type of environment. Obviously, in hospitals, hand cleaning using sanitizers have had a huge impact on lowering infection, okay? Number one. Number two, there is some concern with young children. I've read, again, this is based on my secondhand knowledge, but we are perhaps trying to keep them so clean, super clean, that when they don't get any sort of exposure to their till they're older. I think there are lots of issues around bacteria. Obviously, the use of antibiotics in animal agriculture is a huge one that we've touched on today. So rather than, I think I'm more comfortable kind of looking at in what situation we're talking about, you know, these hand sanitizers and such do help protect us against certain bacteria and viruses, but not all of them. So it's obviously a complicated issue. We really do need to kind of unpack it and figure out what we need to do in what sort of environment to make sure people don't get sick when, in fact, we can prevent those sicknesses.
Annalise, you're up. What do you got? We're going to take a quick break, but I'm going to hold you over. We can start us off here.
Hello, this is Annalise.
Oops. Go ahead. Who is this?
Okay. Yeah, my issue is the ability of the alphabet agencies to act unilaterally. I remember, every once in a while, in a local area.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to come back to you right after this break, so do stay tuned. Hold on right there. Well, Jack asked an interesting question. Can the alphabet soup list of federal agencies actually work together? Gosh, there's a question. Now, someone made mention of the fact that the federal government is not going to supervise things that happen within a state. It's going to be the state. So right there you have two agencies figuring out how to work together. Sandra, will all of those agencies be able to work together to ensure our food safety?
That is the hope and the aspiration. Again, FDA is reaching out to the state ag departments, the state health departments, and trying to work together to do a much better job at targeting problems and be more efficient with the resources. Again, this is a process that's ongoing, and while there's no specific comment period and things to comment document, should say proposal to review, I know the consumer public health community are really, again, making sure that they're doing the right thing. And, we'll see what happens.
David, you're a farmer growing rutabagas for Marin County, and you're all of a sudden faced with the prospect of 1,000 new food safety protocols. What do you do?
Well, your advantage is you're growing rutabagas, and rutabagas are exempt from this rule. But if you're growing lettuce, well, then, yeah.
I guess everybody's got to be growing rutabagas.
Rutabagas.
Then, right?
Some of us really like rutabagas. Eat them raw, but that's not what FDA thinks.
Well, you know, maybe that's the result. We just eat rutabagas and potatoes and things. Who knows? But, you know, lettuce... say, and the rule is you're exempt, you have a qualified exemption if you sell less than $500,000 a year and sell 50% or more directly to the public, to restaurants, or to stores. And so, you know, in Marin County, you might well escape this federal regulation. You know, but the states, you know, will have to do something. We think every farmer needs to have a food safety plan.
Amen.
Right? But we think it should be appropriate to what the farmer is doing and so forth. So we're working very hard to try to make that happen. But I think it's mainly an educational thing, right? We have a huge educational thing ahead of us here.
Well, let me ask you both this my question of the day, which is, can local agriculture survive 1,000 new rules from the FDA? David?
I hope so. You know, there's some of these rules that will make it very difficult, right? I mean, if you produce and do everything on your own farm, you're better off than if you try to get a few farms together and under these rules. So that's going to be a challenge.
Kind of rules out cooperatives.
Well, I mean, maybe a legal cooperative, but, you know, you're going to face stricter regulation. So the informal cooperation that usually goes on, that's going to be more difficult if these rules survive as they are.
Sandra, what do you think?
Yes, it can. First of all, it's a very long document, no doubt about it, but most of it is discussion. The drafts are not 100 pages or 100 protocols. That said, for those entities that are covered, it may be new requirements that they're not familiar with. So there are certainly resources, not even from the government, but organizations like familyfarmed.org, that want to help small farmers who don't have food safety plans, want to understand the regulations, do the right thing, understand where there's flexibility. So I think, yes, it is new, but it hopefully will not be onerous.
So we have a hopefully from both of you, I think. So I want to thank both of you, Sandra Eskin, for joining me, and also Dave Runston from Community Alliance with Family Farmers, and thank all of you people who called in but can't get in because we just ran out of time. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.